Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. There's been landmark news here in the coalfields. After 10 days of deliberation, jurors have found former Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship guilty of conspiring to violate federal mine safety standards. It's a misdemeanor charge that could mean up to 1 year in prison for the former executive. Blankenship was found not guilty on two felony counts of making false statements. The charges stemmed from an April 2010 explosion at Massey's Upper Big Branch mine in Montcoal, West Virginia. The blast killed 29 men who were working underground.
On the fifth day of April, 2010, death came looking for 29 men and took away the spirits like a feather in the wind.
In Montcoal, West Virginia.
Judy Jones Peterson lost her brother in the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. After the verdict was announced, Jones stood at the steps of the federal courthouse in Charleston and addressed a crowd of reporters.
I want to thank the jury for making this decision. To Mr. Blankenship, I say you now wear a cloak of criminal shame. Though you're not convicted on all counts, you are convicted here. You are judged here as a liar, a cheat, and fraud. History, however, will judge you for your true crime, the reckless disregard of human life and the negligent homicide of 29 innocent souls purely out of your own selfish greed.
Peterson said she also hopes this historic verdict will make companies increase safety precautions for all workers.
And most importantly, we say never again. This case sends a message to all CEOs, owners, and operators. You are on notice. You are responsible for the health and safety of your members.
But Peterson didn't lay blame entirely on Blankenship. She also blames his former top mining officials at Massey and the federal organization charged with protecting the health and safety of miners.
To MSHA, the Mine Health and Safety Administration, you failed miserably to do the job entrusted to you to assure the health and safety of our lost loved ones. You let a rogue organization operate way outside the scope of the law. UBB had more unwarrantable failures than any other coal mines in the United States of America, and you allowed them to conduct business as usual, putting countless lives at risk. We hold you as responsible for the loss of our loved ones, as Don Blankenship and his henchmen. You had the power to prevent this disaster, and you did nothing. You had an unwarrantable failure on your watch. We asked President Obama and his labor secretary to do a blitz investigation of your organization. We asked them to clean up your house.
And Tony Opegard agrees that MSHA is partly to blame for the Upper Big Branch disaster. Opegard's an attorney from Kentucky who's represented miners and their families for about 30 years now. He also served as advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration.
Blankenship was an outlaw coal operator, a rogue operator for years and years and years, and MSHA did not do enough to rein him in. Who knows why? You know, he was a powerful guy. Some people in MSHA in the district level were too close to him. That may have had something to do with it.
Opegard points out that since the Upper Big Branch blast in 2010, MSHA has made some changes. He says one action he applauds is more frequent inspections called mine blitzes or impact inspections.
A blitz is when you send multiple inspectors to a mine. They take control of the phone so that nobody can call underground to say, you know, you have inspectors outside who are coming in. And they fan out over the mine. Say there's two or three working sections in a mine, the inspectors will go to each section at the same time. And that's the only way that MSHA inspectors truly see the working conditions of miners.
The United Mine Workers of America is reacting. The union sent out a release hours after the verdict. In it, President Cecil Roberts said, "A message has gone out today to every coal operator in America who was willing to skirt mine safety and health laws. You do so at your own personal risk." The U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas E. Perez released this statement. Today's verdict sends a clear message that no mine operator is above the law, that there must be accountability when people lose their lives because of the neglect of their employer. Workers in this country have the right to go home safe and healthy at the end of every shift, and the jury clearly recognized the violation of that right in this case. But Opegard has little hope that the verdict will affect the other operators. He says Blankenship is one of a kind.
The only CEOs or presidents of coal companies that I've known in all the years I've been doing mine safety work who were as intimately involved as Mr. Blankenship was at Upper Big Branch are owners of very small mines. So, for instance, I was a mine safety prosecutor in Kentucky. We had an accident. This was back in the early 2000s where a miner was killed, and the guy who owned the mine worked there every day. He was an electrician. He was outside every day. He went underground on occasion, and he was charged. Criminal charges filed against him, and he was convicted, and he went to jail for a short period of time. And that itself was very unusual, but that's at a small mine. So when you talk about CEOs, you're usually talking about these major coal companies. And in that sense, I mean, Mr. Blankenship's just totally different than anyone else. Most CEOs of major coal companies, you know, sit in Pittsburgh or New York or Philadelphia or St. Louis, wherever. They're nowhere near the mine, the coal fields. They're not near the mine. They have other people dealing with those day-to-day small details of operating the mine, and Blankenship was different. And that's why I don't think that the verdict is going to send shivers down the spines of other coal mine company presidents and CEOs. I really think it's going to be limited to the facts of this case. Had it happened 25 years ago, maybe it would have more of an impact. But I don't think it will have a major impact now on the coal industry or how people do business for those mines that are still in operation that have survived this this slump in the mining business.
Opegard says what this verdict brings, other than possible jail time or a fine for Blankenship, is some closure for the families. U.S. Senator Joe Manchin said something similar in an email message following the verdict. While nothing can ever bring back the 29 beloved souls we lost on that tragic day, I hope that today brings some closure and peace to the families of the miners. Shirley Witt, whose brother Boone Payne died at Upper Big Branch, says she doesn't think she'll feel like it's over until after Blankenship's sentencing in March. She spoke to Ashton Mara and other reporters at the courthouse after the verdict.
Cheryl, how are you feeling today? How are you feeling?
Disappointed. Right? Disappointed a bit. Somewhat relieved that it wasn't a hung jury. I'm glad he was guilty. We know, everyone knows he was guilty of conspiracy. So he's not walking away from this, even though it's a misdemeanor. But when they said not guilty on the other two, it was kind of like someone just hit you in the stomach.
Still, Witt says she's relieved the verdict doesn't allow Blankenship to come out completely blame-free.
He could have walked away not guilty of all three charges. So just for him to be brought to this and know that he wasn't in control, to me that's worth it, just to see him sit there every day and have to listen of the kind of person he was. That kind of gave me some, I felt like that was speaking for all the 29 miners that passed away.
So the judge will have the final decision in sentencing, and it's a misdemeanor charge, so it could just be a fine. It could be up to a year in prison. What would you say to her as she starts to consider this?
I hope she considers that the evidence was so strong that this man should not be able to walk away with a fine. A fine doesn't mean anything to Don Blankenship, unless you're talking about hundreds of millions, and it's not going to be that. What would affect Don Blankenship is to go to prison for a year.
One reporter asked Witt what she thought of Blankenship's demeanor after the jury verdict came in.
Do you know, I didn't see him. I couldn't look at him. I didn't want to see his face at that point. I thought the worst thing I could do is look at his face and he have a smile on it. I don't think that would have been hard to handle after all this.
Witt says she doesn't feel justice has entirely been served in the Blankenship case.
I look around and I looked at his lawyers. They did a good job. But money does talk. If that had been me up there, they would have put me in prison for the rest of my life if I had done what this man has done. So
just to hear the words guilty was important to me.
I think that's all I have. I'm just drained. It's been a long 2.5 months and a long 5.5 years.
Just to be clear, technically this verdict doesn't mean Blankenship has been blamed with causing the Upper Big Branch disaster. He was accused of conspiring to violate mine safety standards and conspiring to impede mine safety officials, not causing the deaths of the 29 men. In 7 weeks of testimony, U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin's office called 27 witnesses, including several former Upper Big Branch miners. The defense rested its case without calling a single witness. Scott Halstead is a former miner at Upper Big Branch. He testified during the trial and spoke with me outside the courthouse.
Why did you say you were doing this today?
I'm doing it for the 29 that perished. You know, they were my close... They were my close friends. You know, I worked with them every day. You know, it was just like family. You know, every morning you sit and you talk about your families and conditions of the mines. And you know, it was just a close-knit outfit. You know, and when you lose one, you know, you lose a part of yourself. And I just wanted to do what was right. You know, it's all I could do to, you know, help the families of the ones that lost their loved ones.
Halstead says the past few years have been hard for him, and speaking out wasn't something he felt safe to do before. And he hopes his testimony sends a message to other coal miners, too.
Don't take nothing for granted. You know, you got the right to do what is right. And, you know, with the way mining is today, you can't take nothing for granted. You know, it can happen in an instant. No matter how safe you are at a mine, there's always something that can happen in just a blink of an eye.
Speaking up about poor safety conditions was something that was basically unheard of at this Massey-owned mine in West Virginia before the disaster in 2010. Steve Morgan testified before Congress just 2 months after he lost his son, Adam Morgan, in the blast.
I said, tell them you think it's unsafe and you want to be put out by in a safer area, go to the trainee, see what they tell you. The boss pulled him to the side there by himself and told him, said, if you're going to be that scared of your job, or you need to rethink your career.
There were two survivors of the disaster. One of them was Stanley Goose Stewart. Goose gave some of the most emotional testimony in the case, breaking down on the stand as he remembered the code of silence UBB miners followed. He spoke with me in 2012.
Working under Massey, they didn't care. For some reason, they seemed like that was in their agenda to just break the rules, and they didn't have to follow the law. It was like they had a mentality that the laws were stupid. That's my take on it.
West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Ashton Mara has been covering the trial since it began on October 1st. In the final episode of the podcast, Blankenship on Trial, on the eve of the verdict, Ashton talked with the podcast's host, Scott Finn, about the verdict, its implications, and what comes next, with Charleston attorney and former assistant U.S. attorney, Mike Hissom.
So, Mike, are you surprised at all to hear the verdict was split in this way?
I'm not, Scott. Counts 2 and 3. Which charged a false statement filed with the SEC in a press release and securities fraud to the investing public in a press release after the explosion were novel and difficult charges, and based on the notes that the jury sent out during the trial, something that they struggled with. Charging as crimes broad, somewhat general statements in a press release. As to count one, it's a conspiracy, which is, as we've talked about before, a broad tool for federal prosecutors to use. And the question of the penalty, which object of the conspiracy the jury selected, was something that honestly may not have been abundantly clear to the jury. They weren't told that the penalty would change so dramatically based on which check mark they put next to which line. and they checked the first line, which is the conspiracy, the object of which was to violate the federal mine safety standards. They did not check the second line, which was a conspiracy to defraud MSHA, Mine Safety and Health Administration. And had they checked that second box, it would have been a five-year statutory maximum penalty, and a much more significant crime. But I don't think it's surprising at all that the jury came down that way.
And so it's important to note here that it ended up being a misdemeanor crime that he was convicted of, and not the other felonies that they could have convicted him of, as you're saying. Ashton, the U.S. Attorney's Office spent 5 years investigating this case. After all this time, was U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin satisfied with the outcome?
He says that he was. Mr. Goodwin held a press conference after the verdict, and he said he and his team of attorneys in the office, they were celebrating the verdict. He called it a victory. Here's a portion of what he had to say.
I'm not in any way disappointed with this result. I think it brings justice, justice that was long overdue in this case. I think the most serious conduct, certainly, that he was involved in, that is the defendant, was willfully violating the mine safety laws and placing his miners, those who work for him, at risk. So certainly I think that the jury's verdict speaks volumes in this case.
So Mike, you were involved as a former assistant U.S. attorney in the initial phases of this investigation before Blankenship was involved, but still the Upper Big Branch investigation. You've worked for and with Booth Goodwin, the U.S. attorney in this. What is your assessment of how they prosecuted this case?
I think Booth Goodwin, and honestly, from his swearing-in ceremony about a month after the explosion, Scott, made it clear that he was going to take a fresh look. And as we've talked about before, he was going to have the FBI, not MSHA, he was going to have the FBI run this investigation, and that he was going to seek to hold individuals accountable, and that he was going to go higher up the corporate chain. And the takeaway from Booth Goodwin and from Steve Ruby, the assistant United States attorney who was the first chair lawyer at Mr. Blankenship's trial and who's led this investigation, their takeaway will be that they did that. That they, for them, it will be mission accomplished. They convicted the CEO of a publicly traded coal company for mine safety violations, for a conspiracy to break the mine safety laws. That will be their talking point. And there are two prosecutors who do not focus particularly on the number of days that any particular defendant is going to serve in a federal penitentiary. They focus instead on convictions and on convictions of some significance. And for them, they will consider that to have been victory.
Right. I think that came across pretty clearly in the press conference as well. Steve Ruby made a brief statement at the end of the press conference and said that you can't judge justice by the length of time a defendant or someone who is convicted will spend in jail. Another thing that I think is important to consider when it comes to the sentencing, though, is Judge Berger herself. And she doesn't necessarily have a reputation for being a light sentencer. And so coming up with a 12-month sentence, I'm not sure that that's unreasonable for us to believe that she'll do.
So, Ashton, Mr. Blankenship was not led out of the courthouse and sent to jail, right? Could you explain what happened and what's going to happen next?
Right. So after the verdict was given, Steve Ruby made a motion that he would like to have Don Blankenship detained. He said that he poses a flight risk. That basically he has, although he had to give up his passport as part of the original bond, he has the ability to leave the country if he really wants to. He has basically the financial means to do so. He moved to have him detained. And then he said, if you're not going to detain him, we'd like to impose a $10 million bond and home confinement. But Judge Berger basically said, you know, Mr. Blankenship has been cooperative. He's been present at every hearing. He's been attentive. And she didn't see any reason to change any part of his bond. So the original bond has been kept in place. It's a $5 million cash bond. He's given up his passport. He's not getting that back. And he has travel restrictions placed on him. He'll have to stay in the Southern District of West Virginia. He's allowed to go to Pike County, Kentucky, and to D.C., where his attorneys are located.
And of course, he will be appealing. We heard from his lead attorney, Bill Taylor, who said that they plan to do that as soon as possible.
Right. So today was really the first time that we got to hear from Taylor at all. And he was critical of both the prosecution and of Judge Berger's rulings in the statements that he made.
Well, we have a lot of grounds for appeal that go back to the insufficiency of the indictment in the first place, not to mention evidentiary rulings and so forth. Now, this is a record which will be very full of errors on appeal. I'm as confident as I've ever been that the Court of Appeals will reverse the conviction.
Mike, what do you think of the defense's chances of getting this reversed?
I think they're extraordinarily difficult. The current makeup of the Fourth Circuit, the Fourth Circuit has historically been a difficult case for a difficult court for a defendant to succeed in obtaining a reversal of conviction. And given the current makeup of the 15 judges who serve on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, I think it would be very difficult for Don Blankenship to reverse this misdemeanor conviction. I think the Fourth Circuit will take a close look at it. I think that they will allow him oral argument, which is not something that they do in every case, but I think in a case of this high profile, they will. But I think that he will be fighting an uphill battle.
What are the issues that you expect them to appeal?
I think one of the first ones, and something that bothered them and has been a big issue, is the omission of the citations, the actual MSHA citations being admitted into evidence when they weren't issued to Don Blankenship and Don Blankenship didn't see them. That's something that was commented on throughout by the defense team. The one of the other things is the inability through the government's witnesses to play videos that they called exculpatory that helped Don Blankenship, and they were videos of particularly a safety meeting at Scott High School that the company put on to stress the importance of safety. I think it's also safe to assume that the defense will renew their attack on the failure of the judge to sever count one, the count that led to a conviction, from counts two and three. Counts two and three were important, very important to this trial, even though they did not result in a conviction, because they allowed the government to talk about the explosion at Upper Big Branch, because the press release followed the explosion. And they allowed the government to talk about Don Blankenship's immense personal wealth and his stock options and play many recordings that were very unfavorable to Don Blankenship. Given that he was acquitted on counts two and three, I think that'll be a focus to say these were improper. The jury didn't even convict on them, and it tainted the trial for the jury to hear these two categories of evidence. It tainted their verdict on count one.
So, Ashton, you've been covering this thing from the very beginning. What are some of the impressions of this trial that you're going to take away?
I think that maybe it's just because of what I do and who I am, but the things that stick out to me are those emotional moments where I connected with people. So probably because it's still fresh in my mind, but sitting with the family members as we waited for the jury to deliberate, that's something that will always stick out to me. The testimony of the miners who worked underground, who testified about these conditions that they had to work in, specifically the miner who said that he had to walk through water up to his chest. And then, of course, Bill Ross. His testimony was so emotional that you could tell that he truly wanted to make a difference. I think those emotional moments, those are the ones that are going to stick with me the longest.
That was West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Ashton Mara speaking with Scott Finn and former Assistant U.S. Attorney Mike Hissom. All of them have been following the Don Blankenship trial week to week since the beginning of October. To learn more about what went down during the trial, head to wvpublic.org to check out the previous episodes of the Blankenship on Trial podcast. As Ashton Mara mentioned in the podcast, Don Blankenship's attorney, Bill Taylor, says they will appeal the guilty conviction.
Case should never have been brought. There was never enough evidence to justify convicting Mr. Blankenship of any of these offenses. I'm confident that we'll prevail on appeal, but certainly for the moment, everybody wants to relax, rest, enjoy the Christmas holidays, and we'll see you back here in the spring.
Tony Obergard says he thinks Blankenship has a good chance to win those appeals.
You know, in America, we really have two systems of justice. We have one system for everyday normal people, and we have another completely different system for rich people. And Blankenship is immensely wealthy. And, I mean, who among us can afford 20 lawyers working on a case? And that's the two systems of justice. And you figure that if they filed 100 motions during the trial and after the trial, that maybe a few of those that were denied by the court are going to be reversed on appeal. Who knows? I think the fact that you have so many motions having been filed by very competent attorneys, it raises the chance on appeal that a court will accept one of them at least, that there's going to be some grounds that they'll say that Judge Berger was in error and her error affected the outcome of the trial and therefore we're going to overturn the verdict and order a new trial. It would not surprise me at all.
Again, Blankenship was convicted on conspiracy to violate federal law, which is a misdemeanor. Opegard says current mine safety laws are weak and contain very few felony charges. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Sing, little bird. Sing for the skies and your freedom. It's dark in this hole and our bodies are bonded. Yours to the miner.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Tony Opegard and learn about another major mine disaster whose anniversary was just last month. You're Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time.
We read in the paper and the radio tells us to raise our children to be miners as well. Tell them how safe the mines are today, and to be like Daddy, bring home a big pay. Now,
today on Inside Appalachia, we've been hearing reactions to the verdict in the Don Blankenship trial. Family members of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster are still grieving for their loved ones. And of course, no verdict is going to make that grief go away. But it might help bring closure to the families, something that families of the victims of another disaster are still searching for. The tragedy in Farmington in 1968 killed 78 men after an explosion ripped through an underground coal mine in West Virginia. The widows of the families demanded safer working conditions and action from Congress. The disaster was one of the instrumental forces that led Congress to pass the 1969 Federal Mine Safety Law, also referred to as the Coal Act. The legislation was more comprehensive than any previous mine safety legislation. The law required 2 annual inspections of every surface coal mine and 4 at every underground coal mine. It also gave federal inspectors more authority in enforcing mine safety violations by issuing fines. Still, as we have seen again and again, some outlaw coal company owners aren't necessarily deterred by these fines, as we saw in the Upper Big Branch mine that Don Blankenship oversaw. Another important piece of the 1969 mine safety law was that it helped provide compensation for miners disabled by black lung. And while mine fatalities haven't stopped completely since the 1969 legislation, the number of deaths of miners has decreased dramatically. And with each decade, the mine disasters have killed fewer men. In 1968, 311 Americans lost their lives in the mines. By 1980, that number had dropped by more than half, down to 133. In 2009, the year before the Upper Big Branch mine explosion, just 18 American coal miners died on the job. Again, here's attorney Tony Opegard to talk about what kind of an impact the Farmington mine disaster and the 1969 law had for miners and more mine safety history.
It was Consolidation Coal Company, again, you know, a company ignoring basic safety rules that got a bunch of miners killed. And at the time, 1968, I mean, every year there was hundreds of miners who would be killed in the United States. It was not rare. It was just rare to have 78 at one time. And you also had the iconic photo taken by the photographer from the Charleston paper of the giant mushroom cloud outside of the mine that looked like an atomic bomb. And you see the helicopter hovering in the upper right-hand corner of this photo. And I think it was shocking to people. And this was the earlier years of television when those images were on TV and people were shocked and outraged. And it spurred Congress to pass the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969. And I think that explosion and that tragedy was historic and has benefited countless numbers of miners. I would say that literally thousands of miners' lives were saved because of the legislation that came about from the Farmington disaster. And you've heard the expression through the years that all mine safety legislation is written in the blood of miners, and that's really true, that the only time we get legislation is after there's been an explosion that's killed multiple people. Most miners in Appalachia and throughout the United States die one at a time, and no one ever hears about their deaths other than the family members. And, you know, there's no legislation that comes about if a miner is killed because of unsafe conditions in eastern Kentucky today. It's going to be forgotten about a week from today by everybody except for the family members. And I've represented families of miners who were killed underground, and I know firsthand the anguish that people go through and how it affects many, many people for a long period of time. So I'm thinking of the Kentucky Derby disaster. It was May 20, 2006, and there was 5 miners killed in that disaster. And I helped represent 4 of the families of the dead miners, plus the sole survivor of that disaster. So you had young children at the time who have grown up without their fathers, who have missed all of those things that kids enjoy sharing with their parents. You know, whether I'm thinking one family in particular that had 2 young girls. So one of them's graduated from high school, has gone on to college. The other one, you know, has gone through her 8th grade graduation, is now in high school, and they've missed birthdays with their dad. They've missed Thanksgiving, Christmas, you know, going to the prom, et cetera, someday probably getting married. And all these milestones, these achievements in life that they have not been able to share with their father because he died in a dog hole mine that didn't care about safety. So it has an impact for years and years. I can think of just about a year or so ago, I got a message on Facebook from a young lady whose dad was killed in the South Mountain explosion in Norton, Virginia. And that was in 1991. And I think I had met her once as a young child, and she had written to me about how she still grieved over the loss of her father. Now, this is, say, 2014. It was, 20-some years afterwards, and how she still misses him and all the things she missed out in her life. So what I'm saying is that it has this unimaginable effect on people that you don't understand until you've been through it. And that's how all of the families of the Upper Big Branch miners still feel today. It's been 5 years, 5.5 years, but they still feel the effects of those of the disaster. They're still very passionate about it. What's different about Farmington is something came of the Farmington disaster. you had this major piece of legislation that changed the rules of how mining was done in the United States. And then in 1976, you had the Scotia disaster in Letcher County in eastern Kentucky. And it was March of 76, and there was two separate explosions that were 2 days apart. The first one killed a bunch of miners, and then you had rescue team going underground looking for the bodies, and you had a second explosion which killed a bunch of members of the rescue team. My memory is I think there was 15 miners killed in the first explosion and then 11 mine rescue people, including some federal mine inspectors, in the second explosion. You had these twin explosions that killed 26 miners. And again, that spurred Congress to action, and they held hearings. Representative Carl D. Perkins from Knott County, Kentucky, held a congressional hearing, and Congress passed the Federal Mine Safety and Health Act of 1977. And it strengthened the 69 Act. It put in provisions to protect whistleblowers. These are miners who complain about safety, unsafe conditions underground, or miners who refuse to work in unsafe conditions. That law protected those miners. And those two laws together, the 69 Coal Act and the 77 Mine Act, have saved literally thousands of lives over the years. And our death rates have gone down in America from hundreds of miners in the late 60s down to now. You know, if there's 15 miners killed in a year now, you would think that's a really bad year. And so it has had a tremendous effect. The sad part about Upper Big Branch is that nothing has grown out of Upper Big Branch. Not one piece of meaningful legislation has occurred on a federal level. Some has on state level in Kentucky and in West Virginia to a lesser degree, but nothing from the federal government. And although Upper Big Branch was the worst mine disaster since the Hurricane Creek disaster in 1970, where you had 38 miners killed, it was the worst disaster in 40 years in America, yet Congress didn't have the will to pass meaningful mine safety legislation. And there's certainly major loopholes in the federal mine safety law that need to be closed, a law that needs to be strengthened. And Representative George Miller from California introduced a reform bill, and Senator Byrd from West Virginia introduced a similar version in the Senate, and neither of those bills even got out of committee, never were brought to a vote. And I think that's shameful. Commentary on the politicians in Congress at that time.
Last November, a new civil lawsuit was filed on behalf of the families of the 78 victims of the 1968 Farmington mine disaster against Consolidation Coal Company. This was after a memo was recently discovered, revealing information that shows mine management may have told their employees to disable a fan ventilation system alarm. The memo was written by a federal mine inspector, Larry Lane, back in 1970. Writer Bonnie Stewart actually discovered the memo while she was researching a book about the Farmington mine disaster. Considering how much this memo has changed what we know about the Farmington disaster, reporter Michael Klein decided he wanted to hear more. So earlier this year, he went to talk with Larry Lane, and here's part of their conversation about his discovery while he was investigating the cause of the number 9 explosion.
And while I was at number 9, I found a man who was outside electrician. And on this shift, I was outside in charge. I didn't go inside. I was outside in charge, taking care of the phone calls and notes and everything. And I saw this man that I recognized because I had seen him in Fairmont. That's where I lived at the time. And so I got to talking to him, and he was an outside electrician. We were talking about the explosion, and I asked him about the mod run fan. When it went down, why nobody knew about it? Because each fan has to have an alarm system, and that alarm has to be stationed where somebody can see it at all times. And he said, well, that alarm has been disconnected. And I said, who disconnected it? He said, me and the chief electrician. I said, why did you do that? And he said, the chief electrician said that that fan kept going down and they were having trouble with it. And every time the fan went down, they didn't want to pull the men out of the mine. So this man told me, he said, the chief electrician said they told him to disconnect the fan alarm system. Said, so we disconnected the fan alarm system.
They told him, meaning?
Pardon?
He said they told him?
He said they, meaning upper management, told the chief electrician, told him to disconnect. That would be your superintendent or my informant. And so I wrote a memorandum, and I told exactly what he said, that he had disconnected the fan alarm system, and when the fan stopped, the men are supposed to be withdrawn within 15 minutes. Okay, they disconnected this fan alarm system, so when that fan went down, they didn't withdraw the men. They just let them stay in the mine. They had three other fans, but each fan has a certain area to ventilate. So this area where Maud's Run was ventilating was ventilated, and that's what happened. It let the gas build up, and then something exploded. Some ignition caused the explosion.
That was former mine inspector Larry Lane speaking with reporter Michael Klein. Klein interviewed Lane for a book called Truth Be Told, where a transcript of the interview was first published. And you can hear more of this interview with Larry Lane on our website at wvpublic.org. A memorial service is held every year on the Sunday before the Farmington Mine Disaster Anniversary. Our producer, Roxy Todd, attended the service this year and sent us this report.
So I'm standing here. We're at the memorial of the Farmington Mine Disaster. We're standing in a field surrounded by trees, most of which have lost their leaves. It's a beautiful sunny day. I'm looking at a crowd of about 150 people here, remembering their family members who died here 47 years ago in 1968.
It was the explosion heard around the world. We'll never forget it. And we'll never forget my dad, David Manila.
This is Aida Manila Everhart. Next, I go speak with a woman who says she was 5 years old when the explosion took place.
And would you mind just introducing yourself?
I'm Sharon Clellan. I'm the daughter of David Cartwright. He was 35 when the explosion happened.
Sharon Clellan was too young to remember much from those days, except for her mother's tears. In the days after the explosion, family members poured in from across the country. Carlo Tarley had just begun serving in the U.S. Army at the time when his brother Dewey was killed in the Farmington disaster.
So they put me on a bus, and then we come up here, and we stayed for 10 days until they sealed it, which made me really mad.
Carlo's brother's body was left underground, along with the bodies of 77 other men who died in the disaster.
I had dreams, terrible dreams, because he was young. You'd be dreaming he went to Australia. It was just hard to get in your mind he was actually dead.
These thoughts affected Carlo so much that in 1971, when the mine was unsealed, he served as a member of the mine rescue team responsible for recovering bodies. His brother's body was recovered, but 19 other bodies were never found.
And the others, it's still under, I'm sure their families are still really tore up about the fact that they never did get to bury their loved ones the way you should, and actually see it and know for sure.
For many, there's never been closure. That's one reason the memorial service keeps growing year after year. Many people attend every year, including United Mine Workers of America President Cecil Roberts.
The explosion rocked these hills and rocked these hollows, and when you see photos of that mine shaft with the smoke bellowing out of it, you knew there wasn't much hope.
Cecil Roberts brought up the point that it was the grieving widows who led the efforts to fight for better mine safety legislation following the Farmington disaster.
It was the widows and the families and others who marched on Washington and said enough is enough. And we owe them a debt of gratitude because they didn't just stop when they lost their loved ones. They turned that tragedy into something good. And because of their actions, they saved thousands of coal miners. Thousands. We owe them a debt of gratitude, and I think we ought to applaud them today for their efforts.
1 year after the Farmington disaster, Congress passed the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969, which helped protect miners.
If it wasn't for this disaster, the Mine and Safety Act of today probably would not even exist.
Again, this is Sharon Clellan, who lost her father in the Farmington disaster.
I have a son that's in the coal mines today. I have a niece that's in the coal mines. Technology of today is 100% better than what it was 47 years ago. Makes it a little bit easier, but you never stop worrying. Never.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
For the past 8 years, Sharon has sung Amazing Grace for the ceremony.
The grace appear, the air I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares,
it was her dad, David Cartwright, who taught her how to sing just before he died.
But now I'm found, was blind, but now I see.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
Nobody at the state or federal level ever tried to file criminal charges against Consol for actions relating to the Farmington Mine disaster, unlike in the trial of Don Blankenship. In Bonnie Stewart's book about the mining disaster called The Number 9 Mine, she points out that in late 1982, the widows of the Farmington disaster reached an agreement with Consol, and the lawsuit was dismissed. Stewart wrote, "At the time, the federal government had no power to prosecute the company. The state of West Virginia did have the power, but did not use it. Given the sworn testimony taken during the Number 9 hearings and the physical evidence discovered during the 9 years of recovery efforts, both the state and federal governments easily could have assigned fault for the disaster. Neither chose to do so." But as we mentioned earlier, there is a lawsuit currently making its way in the court system. The family members of the 78 miners who died are suing Consolidation Coal for the company's involvement in the Farmington Mine disaster 47 years ago. Losing a loved one in a sudden, violent action is something you never get over. I don't believe it was my father's time to die in 2001. He should have been here to attend my graduation, walk me down the aisle, and meet his grandkids. It's a club, you know, you just don't want to be in. After meeting some of the families of the Upper Big Branch explosion, it was clear that we shared this membership. And at times, I was more of a member than a reporter. And I hope that connection made things a little easier for the families, as I know they've given me strength through the coverage. I know I had lots of questions after my dad died, and I thought maybe I could help find answers for other families. There doesn't seem to be a way to make mining a job with no risks. There will always be mistakes, and likely there will be mine owners and inspectors who cut corners and take chances. But it shouldn't stop us from demanding justice and standing up for what's right. And even after disasters like the one at Upper Big Branch, there are still a lot of people who'd be glad to go back to the mines, if only the jobs were there, to risk their lives to put supper on the table. For the remaining jobs, I hope the miners will never be forced to work in conditions they know are unsafe.
Didn't give a warning, didn't give a sign, didn't see it coming, they were took down from behind by that methane devil.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Music in today's show was provided by Jake Sheps and Catherine Clare, who performed Miner's Lullaby, written by James Lowe. Music was also provided by Stacy Grubb and Alan Cathead Johnston with Montcole, West Virginia, Ben Townsend with Hey, 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 and the late Hazel Dickens with The Mannington Mine. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. Our audio mixer is Scotty White. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Watch my baby girl and be close by her side. I'll be watching her from heaven if I don't make it back outside. In Montcole, West Virginia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.